trust that we'll have a good time together thinking about things that are very important to all of us who are involved in the ministry of music in the church. We have a lot of things to cover in a short time tonight. You're getting a very compressed version of what I often spend, a couple weeks on with my students at Southwestern Seminary in Texas. But we'll take a good shot at it tonight in at least beginning to paint a picture of the biblical framework within which all of us who are involved in music ministry must think about our roles in worship leadership, if indeed we want to think about them biblically. The entire process began a long time ago. In fact, if we were to pinpoint the ministry of music, it would be exactly 3,000 years ago during the reign of David, when he assigned to the Levitical tribe the responsibility of music leadership within the public worship life of God's people. The Levites had been around for a long time before then, as you probably well know. But at this point in time, when David took over the reign of the kingdom, God had put it in his heart to do some very important things with regard to the worship life of the people of God, not the least of which, of course, ultimately became the very edifice for worship which Solomon completed during his reign. But perhaps more important than that in the long term was the establishment of the formal ministry of music. Those of you who are a part of the ministry of music in your church are a part of a tradition that's 3,000 years old. God has had his musical Levites in every generation. And tonight we want to look at a number of the elements of that picture. Some of our study will be specifically biblical, and some of it will be just some common sense thinking together about application of these biblical ideals that we will talk about. Our first topic tonight involves the church choir. I've been waiting for 4 months to talk about this in specific, and this is the first occasion in my time here to really hit this one head on. For those of you who have outlines, I trust that most of you do who can read and write, have an outline before you so you know where we're going tonight. I want to tackle this question right off. It's kind of a basic, what I call square one question that is intended to help define our ministry in terms of who we are under God. We've already suggested that we are the modern counterpart of the ancient Levitical choir, which, by the way, at the time of David, numbered 4,000 musicians. That's a big music ministry. And 288 of them were musical directors who had responsibility for various choral and instrumental ensembles. You remember the worship was continuous in the temple. It went on day and night, night and day, 7 days a week, 365 days of the year. So it would take quite a staff to maintain a ministry like that. And the Levites did precisely that. So we stand in their train, but we'll say a little bit more about that a little later. But I want to answer the question very briefly tonight. What is a church choir? And the answers to this question may relate to other groups of people who are known by other names. I don't know if it's as true in your country as it might be in mine right now, but there's a lot of renovation going on in the worship life of the church and in music ministries in general, and some of it has to do with nomenclature. Groups that were called choirs before have new fancy flashy names like the People of Praise or something like that. Choir isn't good enough anymore, and so we've got to, you know, spice it up a little bit. And so what I'm saying is, a choir by any other name, however, that whole thing, a choir is a choir is a choir, whatever you call it. And so if some of you are here from churches where you have different names for these ensembles or whatever, know that if it's still essentially a group of singers who get together and sing, the things we're talking about pretty much will apply. What is a church choir? First of all, a church choir is a company of the musically talented. When I say that, sometimes I get laughter out of choirs. They look at one another and they say, uh-huh. There seems to be, at least among Baptists, a rather universal embarrassment about their musical riches, shall we put it, or the lack thereof. I'm often greeted with that kind of reaction. But sincerely, a choir is a musical ensemble. I mean, at base, that's what it is. That's what we're talking about to begin with. A choir is a group of musical people whose musical gifts may be, you know, great, extensive, significant, or very average, or below average. Or a mixture, which is what most church choirs look like, a mixture of all of the above. But at the core of what a choir is this common natural ability of doing vocal music together. And I want to think about the things that we bring to a choir when we talk about a church choir as a company of the musically talented. There are some people who bring to a choir musical ears, if you know what I mean. They've got really good ears for music. They hear a musical line once and it's fixed. It's there in their minds. They hear something and it's like with a computer. You enter it and it's there. And it's just, you only have to enter it once and it's there anytime you need to retrieve it. There are some people who have musical ears like that. They really pick up things very quickly. I remember my son when he was just a little kid. He wasn't even 2 years old yet. The way he would pick up melodies so quickly. One hearing would fix them in his mind. He's got a really fine musical ear. It's much better than he's ever admitted. But some of us have musical ears, and that makes a major contribution to a musical ensemble like a choir. Some of us bring musical eyes to the choir experience. That is, we actually read the language of music. Every choir wishes they had more people like this who actually read the language they're seeking to use. However many or however few, every choir needs a certain level of reading ability if you're going to survive. And the first two things I mentioned, either musical ears or musical eyes, if you don't have a fair amount of both, forget anything else you bring to the process. Because most of the work that the choir does on the purely musical level is dependent on those two things: being able to read music or to learn it by ear very quickly. Those two things. Without a good mix of those, choir becomes very trying and very difficult. And directors have been known to tear lots of hair out and get bald early. Other people bring to the experience what we call musical minds. That is, they understand music very well. And it isn't just that they have good ears or eyes or even combinations of either of those, but they think musically. They're people that probably can hear a melody and harmonize with it immediately because they think theoretically. They think harmonically, and they have musical intuitions that we call the musical mind. They think musically. And it always helps to have people like that in a choir. There are many people who can reproduce a musical score in a very unmusical way. And it's those who have musical minds with those sensitivities that are just built into the way they are, that understand the nature of phrases, for example, and those kinds of things. And you don't have to explain all of that to them all the time. They think musically. They bring a musical intelligence to the process that really helps a choir to be what it is. There are another group of people that you hope you have plenty of who bring musical hearts to the process. These are the people who really feel musically. Music is probably one of the most important ways they express all the deep things they feel about God and about their faith. And they bring a lot of just plain old heart to the process. They may not be great readers, they may not have great voices, but they bring a lot of that very important aspect of the emotional and the feeling level of music. Music is in itself a very emotional art form. And to do it without feeling is to, in a sense, to deny music its right to be what it uniquely is. That is a channel of expressing things that are beyond words. That's the nature of music. It's a language that goes beyond our English language, by which we express things that are deeper than pure words alone can express. Now, God made music for that. This is not an accident. This is not a modern imposition on music in the church. It's the way God designed it, to reach deep within us, beyond words, into those recesses of our being where responses to God cannot find a vocabulary apart from the language of the heart, which God has made music to be. So there are some people who bring to the choir experience musical hearts, and you hope you've got a good number of those. And then probably the last, it wouldn't be the least, but at least last on our list, is musical voices. There are some of us to whom God has given very fine voices. And you hope that you've got a few of these in your choir, some really good voices around which to build your choral sound. No choir wants to sound bad intentionally. We may sound bad accidentally or unintentionally, but no choir wants to sound bad intentionally. But we're not going to be any better than the quality of our voices. You can't get a choir to sound good when all the voices are, you know, pretty raucous. They all sound like sandpaper rather than velvet. We want to have as many good voices as we can in a choral ensemble, but sometimes, it's like at home. What's on the table, you take what you get, right? And sometimes it's that way, and we try to make silk purses, don't we, out of something less. I don't know if that's a saying over here or not, but it registers with a few of you, okay? Well, anyway, that's what some people bring to the process, some really excellent voices. So when we say a church choir is a company of the musically talented, we're saying all of these things. It's a group of people who have various mixes of these musical abilities that are all a part of what you need to be a choral ensemble that can sing the praises of God with a sense of beauty and accuracy and intensity and feeling in the context of public worship. But a church choir is much more than that. It's much more than musical talents, though it's certainly that to start with. A church choir is a company of the personally qualified. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, I want to read a couple texts. If you have Bibles with you tonight, I invite you to turn with me to Titus, Paul's letter to Titus, chapter 1. There are a number of passages in Paul's writings where he talks to various groups of leaders in the church about the kind of personal qualifications that are incumbent upon those who are in leadership roles in the public life of the church. And I want to say right away that the church choir is probably the largest single group of individuals to have regular impact on the entire congregation week after week after week after week. I don't know if you could name another group ministry in the church that begins to have that kind of impact on the congregation at large, as a whole. It's a very major impact. You are definitely, whether you have accepted this mindset about your role, you are definitely part of the leadership team that God uses to bring His people into worship Sunday by Sunday. So I definitely take very seriously these words to Titus and then also to Timothy about the kind of qualities of being that ought to characterize those in spiritual leadership positions. Now, the names of these positions are not the issue. I take them to be representative of all kinds of leaders. If these kinds of things apply to deacons whose job was distributing food and serving people at tables and distributing to physical necessities of people, if these kind of qualities were necessary for deacons, certainly those who lead public worship are equally at issue in terms of the kind of people God wants in leadership positions in the life of the church. But listen to these words from Titus chapter 1. Paul talks about elders and overseers and deacons and others in these various listings of qualities for leadership. At verse 6, he says, an elder must be blameless, the husband of but one wife, a man whose children believe and are not open to the charge of being wild, disobedient. Since an overseer is entrusted with God's work, is this God's work we do? It most certainly is. We are entrusted with God's work in our responsibilities as choral ministers as well. Such people then ought to be blameless, not overbearing, not quick-tempered, not given to drunkenness, not violent, not pursuing dishonest gain. Rather, hospitable, one who loves what is good, who is self-controlled, upright, holy, disciplined, holding firmly to the trustworthy message as it has been taught. These are the same kinds of things you'll find just ahead in 1 Timothy chapter 3, where Paul goes on to talk about the same kinds of leadership qualities for overseers and deacons. And you'll see the very same things coming up on the list and some other words as well. In other words, the people who are given leadership responsibility must have some personal qualities of life that commend their being put in the position of leadership in the household of faith. It's a very simple idea, isn't it? And yet one that I think is often neglected. For example, there would be many churches that I would be familiar with in the States where all you have to have is musical talent, and that's enough. That's all that matters. If you can sing and you've got a pulse, they'll take you. I mean, that's really all that matters. All of these other things are pretty irrelevant. And that's a rather tragic and dangerous course to take, where we ignore the quality of spiritual life that God expects of leadership people. It is not enough to be a good musician. You could be the best musician in the world, but if you lack these qualities of life, you are disqualified from this kind of service in the household of faith. Paul is very strong about the kind of people who should be in spiritual leadership in the church. And I'm not sure in the ministry of music we've always taken those things very seriously. We've kind of given ourselves exclusion clauses at times and put all the priority on musical gifts. Well, that's not all there is to it, is there? There's more than that as we look at the larger biblical picture. A third area which kind of piggybacks on this one is that the church choir is a company of the spiritually gifted. Personal qualifications, these qualities of life, are one issue, but another issue has to do with the spiritual gifts God has given us, and we really don't have time to study that thoroughly tonight, but in Romans 12 and 1 Corinthians 12 and Ephesians 4 and And then there are other shorter listings in other places in the New Testament, some in Peter and additional ones in the writings of Paul, that talk about the charismata, the gifts of grace that God has given to all believers. Now, this isn't like a prerequisite in the sense that there are certain gifts that you must have or you aren't qualified. There's no such thing in the New Testament, nor is there any hint of this kind of thing in the Old Testament. The issue here has to do with our understanding of our own spiritual gifts and how they find release and opportunity for ministry through a musical channel. I would expect that in a church choir there would be a wonderful mix of spiritual gifts. You always hope that there are a few that have the gift of helps. There are always chairs to be moved, aren't there? Every choir director and minister of music in our country has moved a lot of chairs, and you always hope that there are some people in the choir who are just always there. When there was some physical job to be done, something that needs to be taken care of, they're just there to do it. They have that gift. You hope that there are some people in your choir that have that gift, because there are a lot of those things to be done, aren't there? Especially at times when you're doing major things, and the workload in that area goes up. Well, that's only one example. There are other gifts. Like, I would expect, if the people in a church choir have actually been put there by God, I would expect that there are many there that have the gift of exhortation. I would expect that. I would expect that there are other kinds of gifts that are going to be there. The issue is knowing what our spiritual gifts are, so that we may see how it is in this ministry framework, that is, the church choir, my spiritual gifts are relevant and matter and make a difference. Now, I don't know how far along you are in your understanding of spiritual gifts here. Baptists in the States have only in the last 20 years kind of acknowledged that they're there. You know, we've been a little wary of everything to do with the Holy Spirit. And even the spiritual gifts has been a subject which we've not done very well on until recent years. But it would be a tragedy for us to have spiritual gifts and have no idea what they are. I mean, that would really be tragic, because you would probably find your church would be probably as typical of many, which if that were so, you probably got a lot of people trying to exercise gifts they do not have, and many people not exercising gifts they do have. See, not knowing what our spiritual gifts are is a real loser. It's like flying blind. It's like, you know, blindfolding yourself and trying to hit a target. All you can do is hope that you're aimed in the right direction. That really isn't the way to do the most important work on the earth. To do it blindly, to do it haphazardly, to do it by guess. So even with a church choir, we are a company of people who, by God, have been given spiritual gifts. And the spiritual gifts, according to the Apostle Paul, have been given for the common good. Your spiritual gift is not for your good or your blessing or your benefit. Your spiritual gift is for my good and my blessing and my benefit. And my gifts are for your good, your blessing, your benefit. Have you studied this in the Apostle Paul? The common good is the way Paul talks about it. Your spiritual gifts are not for your good. They're for the good of the rest of the body, you see. And so to be a member of a choir that has direct impact on the rest of the body every Sunday of the year and not know what spiritual gifts God has given you by which to channel ministry within that body is a tragedy. It's an absolute tragedy. A church choir is a company of spiritually gifted people. Gifts given to us by the Spirit of God. We need to know what they are to develop a vision for our own ministry of how their relevance pertains to this unique ministry in which God has placed us. The fourth answer to our question is, the church choir is a company of the divinely called. A company of the divinely called. This may be the one in which I would want to camp the most tonight, because I think it's probably most abused in Baptist churches around the world, where they operate on a volunteer system and not on the basis of biblical concepts. Have you ever heard the term volunteer choir? Have you ever heard that? You're all staring at me. Just yes or no? No, you haven't heard the term volunteer choir. Okay, well, that's good. Well, that doesn't mean you're not operating on the principle, however. Because around the world, it appears that most choirs operate on a volunteer choir. It's not a biblical concept, but it's a very popular one in our day, is where we make a choice to offer our services to a given ministry while we're interested in, when we're interested in, as long as we're interested in it. The words in Scripture that describe the way the Lord of the harvest does things is choose, elect, appoint, call. Do you recognize those words? Please say yes. This is the way God works, friends. We must recognize these words. God chooses. God elects. God appoints. God calls. He doesn't look for volunteers. Voluntarism, whether or not you've heard that concept or not, is a concept by which I offer myself to a certain, let's say, a certain ministry which I'm interested in. You know, I like to sing, so I join the choir, right? Okay. If God hasn't called you, get out. If God hasn't called you to that ministry, get out. Now, I didn't come here tonight to empty the choir loft in your church or mine. But I want to say something very serious about the way God does things and the way we do things on the human level. The Lord of the harvest, in line with natural talent and spiritual gifts, calls believers to their ministries. He doesn't look for volunteers. He calls people. He selects and he appoints people. We have not chosen him. He has chosen us and appointed us. This is the way God works. If God has equipped you to do music, he may also call you, but he may not. At any one time in your life, God may not use all of the abilities he's given you. And I would say to all of you, be very sure that you are in the choir because God has put you there, not because you have put you there. Is this a foreign idea? Being where God has placed you? Shouldn't be. Shouldn't be. We don't volunteer for that ministry. We don't volunteer for any ministry. The way God works is God calls people to the ministries. That's the way God works. What's wrong with the other approach? Voluntarism, which is not a biblical concept at all. It has a lot of bad fruit attached to it. First of all, voluntarism creates a convenience mentality. That is, when it's convenient, I'm at choir. When it's not, I'm not. Ever hear of anything like that? Where's your choir director here? Where is she? Yeah. Have you seen anything like this? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know what this is, don't we? Convenience mentality. I come when it's convenient, when it fits my schedule, when it fits in with my other priorities. But when it's not, I'm nowhere to be found. That's what volunteerism breeds, a convenience mentality. Secondly, it breeds a false sense of who's in charge. You see, when I volunteer, I get to stay in charge. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. When I volunteer, I'm in charge, because I can unvolunteer as quickly as I volunteer. You see? Listen, under Jesus Christ, who's really in charge around here? One will be Lord, only one. There is no volunteering. See, I am not in charge. But maybe you can tell whether or not you're a volunteer by this little litmus test. If you're staying in charge of whether you go to rehearsal each week and whether you show up every Sunday, you'll get the picture very quickly. Thirdly, what does volunteerism produce? It produces escape without guilt. Ever hear that? Escape without guilt. I can miss choir rehearsal two or three times in a row and miss a couple services here now and then. In fact, you know, half the year maybe I'm gone, but my name's on the roll. But I don't feel guilty about it, because after all, I'm just a volunteer. Are you beginning to get the picture now? What I'm talking about? This is not a biblical concept that we're painting right now. What else does it do? Well, volunteerism obviously produces a very diminished level of commitment. A very diminished level of commitment. When we're volunteering, what we are committed most to is our decision when to and when not to go. That's where our commitment is. It really isn't to the Lord. It isn't to the ministry. It's to me. It's very self-centered, isn't it? And a fifth bad fruit of this concept is that it creates minimal ownership of the ministry. You know what I mean when I say ownership? These are the folks in the choir who are at the periphery. They don't really own it. And any time there's, you know, something major or question and so forth, they're kind of on the outside looking in. They don't really have ownership. It's not really their thing. It's the choir's thing. You know, they can kind of put themselves, the choir and me, they can kind of create that, because they don't really have ownership. They can take an objective kind of outsider's position, even though their name's on the roll. You know what I'm talking about? Don't really have ownership. Well, those are some of the bad fruits of volunteerism, and maybe that'll be helpful in revealing whether or not you really have a volunteer mentality, whether you use that word or not. The opposite of that is having a confidence that you have been called by God. Hear me, the level of commitment is always in direct proportion to one's call. If God has called you to be a member of the choir, you don't vote on rehearsal night about whether or not you go. You don't ever vote on that again. You don't vote on that. You don't vote on whether or not you sing Sunday morning. You don't vote on that anymore. If God has called you to this ministry, you're there. You understand? You know what I'm saying? It's a very different concept, isn't it, from the very convenient one we've constructed as a way by which to do a lot of the work of the church. A lot of the work of the church is done with this volunteer mentality, whether you use the word or not. You know, where we do it on our own terms, not on His. Okay. Well, that's the fourth answer, and that's very heavy duty, friends. What is a church choir? A company of the divinely called. Called by God. The Lord of the harvest has said, I have gifted you, I have equipped you, I have prepared you, I call you to this ministry. I serve a church of some 4,000 to 5,000 active members in Southern California for 13 years earlier in my ministry. And we had a choir of some 135 people during that time. And one of the ways that we helped to build biblical mindset into the whole approach to music ministry in the church was introduced to people when they first gave any inclination that they might be interested in the ministry of the choir. We had, I guess what you'd call an application form or something like that, really an information form, that people would fill out after they had visited rehearsal for 3 weeks. There were no instant memberships. If you were at all interested, you were asked to come 3 weeks in a row, and then we would sit down and have a chat after the third week. And it was at that time then that this information sheet, about 3 or 4 or 5 pages long, was put in their hands so we could find out, you know, who they were, what their background was, and what experience they've had in music ministry, what instruments they played, if they played instruments, and all of these kinds of things. And then on the last pages, it had some paragraphs about spiritual journey. And then a question: are you confident that God has called you to this ministry? And if a person couldn't sign that, they weren't a part of that ministry. When I came to that church, I said, God, I'm not taking any people into the choir that you're not putting there. They must be your people, not mine. Well, if that wasn't enough, then the second question following that was, if you are married, does your spouse affirm that you are called to this ministry? At Lake Avenue, our choir rehearsals were from 7:30 to 10 on Thursday nights. And when I first came there, I became very aware that I was becoming the bad guy in a number of family situations, where the wife was in the choir and the husband would come home on Thursday night from work and say, honey, let's go out and eat tonight. And the wife would say, well, I've got choir tonight. And he said, oh, you can miss one. You're all once. You're always there. Let's go out and eat tonight. She'd say, but, you know, I'm committed to this. This is my ministry. And pretty soon I became the bad guy to all those men who were married to choir women and all those women who were married to choir men. And I said, I won't be in that position. I don't belong there. I'm not at issue. I won't accept that responsibility whatsoever. And so from that point on, I insisted that anyone who joined that choir had the total blessing of a spouse who said, I release you to this ministry. I affirm God's call on your life for this ministry. And all that bad guy stuff came to an abrupt halt. It was over. It was over. Sense of call. Our commitment is always in direct proportion to our sense of call. Well, the last answer to our question is really where we've been ending up in this last paragraph or two. A church choir is a company of the totally committed. A company of the committed. People who own this ministry as given to them by God, and who say, hey, the choir schedule is mine. This is what I accept. And by the way, that's very important, to let people know what it is they're giving themselves to. At the beginning of every choir year, my choir and I would go on retreat into the mountains for 3 days. We spend an entire weekend, Friday through Sunday, for 3 days. That's how we'd start every singing year after being off for a month. And it used to be a very, very important time for us. It's a time to set vision for the year, a time to kind of get ahead on music, and a time to have lots of a fellowship on a social and recreational, and then far more importantly on a spiritual level. And it was a very important time, but at the very beginning of the year, I put in the choir's hands the entire schedule for the next 9 months. Every extra rehearsal, every special event, every Sunday service that they would be exempted from because of something else, and every additional one that would be added for whatever reasons on Sundays when perhaps we'd have more services. All be there. So at the beginning of the year, the choir knew what it was they were committing themselves to. And if we ever went outside that schedule during the year, I brought it to the choir. And I said, we need another 2 hours. But they vote on it. So I accepted their commitment at the beginning of the year. You're not committing your whole life to the choir, but you're committing this. Thursday nights and Sundays, these extra rehearsals, this is it. Because you see, the choir only is the choir, really, when it's together. See, otherwise, we're just brothers and sisters in the body of Christ. You know, we're not... I'm a choir member sitting next to a deacon, sitting next to a Sunday school teacher, sitting... We're just brothers and sisters in the body. But when we're up there together, when we're rehearsing together, that's when we really are the choir. And I said, this is what we are committing ourselves to. We're committing ourselves to the work of this ministry unit, which will take this many hours in this year. We need to be honest with our people and letting them know what it's going to cost. That's very, very important. Well, commitment. Why is that such a bad word today? Why do we hear that word and we feel negative ions in the room? Okay. It's the way things work in the kingdom of God, isn't it? Commitment is a positive value. It's a proper and good thing. And yet in our time, we often treat it as though it's a negative thing. Be committed. Well, when you're on the other end of commitment, you realize what a positive thing is, you know, to be married to a mate who is committed to you, to have parents who are committed to you, to have friends who are committed to you no matter what. When you're on the other side of commitment, it's a really high value. But when we're talking about ourselves, then it gets negative all of a sudden. Oh, you expect so much. Well, my friends, God expects everything. Everything. We belong to Him wholly, totally, completely. Totally committed. Well, what is a church choir? A company of the musically talented. Different gifts, different abilities. A company of the personally qualified. We're not the average or the run of the mill. Certainly not the bottom of the ladder. We are people whose business it is to be holy and upright before God. To walk with Him. Otherwise, we have no qualification to be in leadership. A company of the spiritually gifted, given gifts by God for the intensification and the amplification of our ministries in the body of Christ. The company of the divinely called. We don't call ourselves. We are called by God. A company of the totally committed, who when God calls us, we are free to give ourselves wholeheartedly, holding nothing back. Well, let's talk about another concept. I don't think it's the next outline in your folder tonight, but turn a little further ahead. We'll come back. Let me see what page that would be. Turn to the one that's headed the leading of worship. Let's talk about this now, shifting gears just for a moment. We'll go back and forth between the music and worship track tonight, because for us as a group, these are tied together, aren't they? These are very closely tied to each other. What do we mean when we say leading worship? What are we talking about? I've used this terminology already tonight, assuming we had some common understanding of what we mean by this, but what are we talking about when we say leading worship? Let me give you two analogies. One is the analogy of the guide. A guide. One of the things that my brother and my father have done a number of times that I unfortunately have never been able to do with them is to go fishing in Canada. They live not too far from the Canadian border, where they hire an Indian guide who always has a plane that looks like it should have been put in the junk heap decades ago. They talk about those planes up in Canada as being put together with baling wire and rubber bands, who fly people into remote lakes where there is no life except in the water and in the wild. There are no people, no cabins, no houses, nothing. A lot of Canada is like vast regions of your country. There's nobody there. Nobody there. And some of the world's greatest fishing is in those lakes, where maybe only three or four fishermen go an entire year. The fish are just waiting. Come, catch me. We need some relief from this boredom. Come, come, fish here. But there are literally thousands of lakes like that in Canada, and I've never been able to do this with my dad and brother, and I always wished I could. But they've done this many times. And the thing that makes this rather wonderful adventure, where you're always guaranteed, I mean, nobody even talks about it. You just know when you hire a guide to go into one of those places, you're going to get your limit just like that. And you're going to end up having to eat an awful lot of fish or throw an awful lot back. See, you can keep as much as you, I mean, you can eat as much as you want, you know. But you can only take back so much. And so you end up throwing back an awful lot of fish. You've got to really just like the sport of it eventually, because it's just an embarrassment of riches when it comes to fishing. Well, it could never happen without a guide. Could never happen. Canada is like your country. It's a big place. And you look at a map of the inland of Canada up there, and you just see thousands and thousands and thousands of lakes, and most of them are inaccessible. I mean, the roads stop here, and then all these lakes are up here. The road comes, you come this far. I've driven to the end of the road in Red Lake, Ontario, Canada. I've come to the end of the road. And then beyond that, there's nothing. I mean, and it's all up for grabs, as it were. It belongs, in a sense, to the hunters and the trappers and the Indian guides. And there's about one of those every, you know, 2,000 square miles. So, I mean, this is unpopulated territory. And you wouldn't dare go out there without a guide. In many of those adventures, the guide drops you off at a cabin that he has built there and leaves you there. This is one of the deals you can do. The boats are there, the motors and everything, and you do it yourself. And he flies out. And you just got to think, when he's flying away, I hope he knows which of these 10,000 lakes to come back to. Because there's no walking back to civilization from there. There are times in life when it's absolutely essential to have a good guide who knows where it's at and how to get there, and also how to get back. I know how important that is because I have gone fishing in Canada in my earlier life before I had left home with my dad and my brother. And we'd gotten too far from home, and night fell, and we couldn't find our way back through a chain of lakes. And we finally, another boat finally came upon us and helped us to get back. So I know what it is to be lost and not know where to turn, where to go up there where one lake empties into another and there are just thousands of them. It's wonderful. But you've got to have a guide. You really have to have a guide. One of the functions of a so-called worship leader is to help guide the people of God in the right direction so that where they end up is together in the Holy of Holies with God. These are people who can say, hey, I know the way. I've been there many times before. Take my hand. I'll bring you to Him. That's what it is to be a worship leader. Helping people get to God. Guiding people in the right direction. Another analogy is a rather famous one that was conceived and published by the Danish philosopher, theologian Søren Kierkegaard, in which he uses the analogy of a drama for the worship event. So think of the worship service, the public worship event, as a drama. And in this drama, there are a number of people who figure into what's happening. Now, Kierkegaard, in his description of this, gave a warning at the outset about the way many people look at this event. And so he said, first, there is a common misconception about worship, which leads to a wrong conception about worship leadership. And the misconception runs something like this. People look at the leaders as the actors, the principals in worship. Okay? I mean, don't we build our buildings to give the impression that the leaders are the thing? We come into the room, all the chairs face them, and all the lighting comes down on them, the spotlights, and that's where the microphones are and all that stuff. The rooms themselves suggest that here's where the action is. So in this misconception, there is the thought that the leaders are the principal actors in this drama. Then who would the congregation be? Well, the audience, of course. Okay. The ones who, if it's good, and oof, boo if it's not, you know. Okay. And so what the people up here are doing are basically, in their own way, seeking to please these people out here, to relate to them and to do something for them. So the concept is that the congregation comes as an audience to watch this thing happen. And where does God fit into all of this? What is God's role in this drama? Well, have you ever been to a play where there was somebody down in the front row there who had the script? Or maybe they were off in the wing, or maybe it was in a theater that has one of those little prompters boxes where in the opera there's somebody besides the conductor who's up there called the prompter. That's what God's role in all of this is. He's keeping the leaders on target. You see, when they lose their lines, He's there just to make sure they stay orthodox or something like that. So God's role in all of this is the invisible, unseen prompter. Kierkegaard says that's the common misconception of the worship event, in which the leaders are the show. Have you ever seen anything like that? It's the most popular model for worship returning to the United States right now. Not by accident, it's intentional. The showbiz model is what we call it in the U.S. right now. Churches that are intentionally creating worship to be something other than biblical worship, they're turning it in basically to a holy show, and the people up front are it. And you don't have to do diddly while you're there. You just put money in the offering and clap after everything, and it's a success. These are people who haven't read church history and who have no idea why the Reformation had to happen. You see, that was just the condition of worship before the Reformation. It was showbiz medieval style. And today we're going right back to that model again in many churches. It's just show business once more. It's not biblical worship. And we're going to spend some good time on that tomorrow. Kierkegaard says that's all wrong. Rightly understood, and this is the middle column, the congregation, they are the actors in worship. The congregation, us, all of us. We have come to act out our love and our praise and our devotion to God. We are the actors in this drama. And who is the audience? God is the audience. It's being done for Him and toward Him. It's being offered up to Him. God is the audience. And what about all those guys up front? What are they there for? They are the prompters. They're the ones who are there to help us, the rest of us, stay on course, to deliver our lines to God, to pour out our hearts to Him. Kierkegaard said, this is the way it really is. And he's right. This squares with the biblical view of worship. Worship is not a spectator sport in the Bible. It's what we, the people of God, come together to do. Out of lives which, in the rest of the days of our week, we have been living in this same kind of communion with God, one by one and family by family. It becomes the sum total of all of that put together. And the leaders are just there to help it happen. And frankly, the larger the group, the more leadership is needed to help things like that happen, to keep it from being Corinthian chaos or any other kind of chaos. Leadership is critical to that. In the wisdom of God, as foolish as it seems, the concept of leadership, human leadership, human vessels through whom God leads and shepherds His flock, is a viable one, and it's still necessary in the church today. So, this is quite a different concept of what it is to lead worship then, isn't it? You see, we're not the show, friends, even though we are up front and under the lights. We're not it.